Caution, the contents of this podcast may be historical, but they're still served piping hot. We're brewing up the classics here on the Coffee House Classical Music Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Coffee House Classical Music Podcast. My name is Asa.
And I'm Allison.
Today, the coffee house becomes Le Château du Café, meaning we're returning to France for another Impressionist composer. This week, we'll be looking at Maurice Ravel and his fluttering Daphnis and Chloe Suite, number 2.
Ravel was born in the Basque region of France in 1875. His mother had grown up in Madrid and his father was Swiss, so already Ravel was off to a worldly start. Soon after his birth, though, Ravel's family moved to Paris. In this fancy artistic town, it was soon discovered that Ravel loved music, and he started piano lessons when he was 7 years old.
Now, of course, the thing to do when you're a young musician in Paris was to enroll in the Paris Conservatory. So in 1889, that's just what Ravel did. He was, however, not a fabulous pianist. Apparently, he was just good. And the environment of the conservatory was very cutthroat. Before he could fully finish his training, Ravel was expelled from the conservatory. The reason? He hadn't won any competitions.
Now I wonder how many competitions there actually were to participate in during Ravel's lifetime. It seems that overall there would be more pupils at the conservatory than competitions for them all to win, so it seems there must have been a significant percentage of the student body that was dismissed each year. Sadly, Ravel then abandoned piano performance as a career. But he didn't give up on music entirely. In 1897, 2 years after his expulsion, he was actually re-accepted to the conservatory, but this time as a composition major.
His primary teacher was the kind and wise Gabriel Fauré, who you can learn about more in episode 31. At this time, Ravel also developed a friendly relationship with Claude Debussy. The two young composers frustrated the administration of the conservatory, particularly the director, Theodore Dubois, with their radical ideas like introducing the pentatonic scale, disregarding triads, and basically looking beyond just the French tradition for inspiration.
Debussy, however, learned to play the system. He made music that he liked, but he could also put on a more prim and proper front for the administration. And as a result, he raked in those good prizes that were so highly valued by the conservatory.
Ravel, on the other hand, refused to be tamed by the administration's stuffy old ideals. And as a result, he still failed to win prizes and was once again expelled.
He kept self-training himself, however, and entered the prestigious Prix de Rome. But almost like the plot to a movie rather than real life, it was impossible for Ravel to actually win because the competition was rigged.
Apparently, one of the judges, Charles Lenepveu, who was rubbing elbows with Dubois in the conservatory administration, only allowed his own students to get through to the final round. So Ravel was eliminated in the first, and it was obvious even to his haters that something was fishy.
This scandal, termed L'Affaire, was finally exposed, and it caused an epidemic of, quote, early retirements from the conservatory. The whole thing might have been good publicity for Ravel, though. He began producing well-loved works such as Rhapsodie Espagnole and Valse Nobile et Sentimentale. He also collaborated with Sergei Diaghilev for the composition of Daphnis and Chloe. Diaghilev was, of course, the director of the infamous Ballet Russe, most famous for the premiere of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring.
During this period, Ravel's friendliness with Debussy gradually moved towards disdain. This is partly due to public opinion. The music-listening public in Paris was very vocal about who and what they liked or didn't like, and pitted Debussy and Ravel against each other. With the power of the people behind it, the idea seemed to lodge in the minds of these two friends, and soon it became true.
Now imagine if there had been the influence of social media during this time. Perhaps there would have been a very public and dramatic feud.
Soon came World War I, and Ravel served his country as a truck driver during the war. Not much in the way of composition during this time. His mother also died in 1917, which was a devastating blow. His most notable work from this time is the lovely Le Tombeau de Couperin, with movements dedicated to friends he lost during the war.
Though Ravel had proven to be an excellent and innovative composer, he also had a rare skill for orchestration. The work that actually earned him the most money, but that he thought the least of in his output, was the orchestration of the piano solo Pictures at an Exhibition, originally by Mussorgsky. This orchestral version is now more well-known than the original.
Soon regaining his compositional inspiration, Ravel took a tour to North America. While there, he famously met a young George Gershwin. As the story goes, apparently both Gershwin and Ravel idolized the music of each other, and Ravel was astonished that Gershwin asked for composition lessons. Ravel felt he had to turn down the offer because he didn't want to take away Gershwin's unique compositional voice.
It seems that Ravel picked up a few tricks from Gershwin, though. His piano concerto in G major is famously jazzy and schmaltzy, as Ravel further expanded his musical horizons with the jazz medium. This same year, in 1928, he also composed one of his most famous works, Bolero.
Unfortunately, though, in the 1930s, Ravel began to show signs of Pick's disease, a form of Alzheimer's. In 1937, he was in a car crash that gave him at least a concussion and didn't help his memory problems. Apparently, his condition got bad enough that therapeutic surgery was attempted. However, this was unsuccessful, and Ravel died less than a month later.
So let's talk about a major orchestral work that is a standard for many professional and amateur orchestras throughout the world, and that is the Daphnis and Chloe Suite No. 2. This suite was assembled in 1914 based on Ravel's ballet of the same name that premiered in 1912, with the Ballet Russes, as we mentioned.
Ravel collaborated with the troupe to create the story of the ballet, however there were clashing ideas all around. The Frenchman Ravel had a dreamy, pastoral view of the story that was set in ancient Greece. However, the choreographer for the group, Michel Fokine, pressed for a ritualistic, sharp dancing that would have been seen next year in the Rite of Spring.
Thanks to Ravel's musical style, the more dreamy quality seems to have won the battle. Ravel arranged the suites later so they could be playable by orchestras alone, without dancers. On his tour to America, he brought the music with him, and the suites resulted in ovations and compliments from the American audiences, a true success.
The score for the work is large, asking for all manner of auxiliary woodwinds in all sections, full brass including tuba, which was fairly new instrument at the time, and an optional chorus. This musical menagerie seems like it would have been difficult to fit in the pit of a ballet hall.
The story of the ballet itself is quite simple. Daphnis and Chloe are shepherds who fall in love and, being Greek, praise Pan for their good fortune. Then, Chloe is captured by pirates.
Oh no!
Pan, feeling sorry for the lovers, rescues her and reunites them by the end of the ballet.
To start the whole thing off, Ravel begins with a sunrise. This is depicted with soft flutes and clarinets playing undulated sequences. Interestingly, these are not just arpeggios, but rather involve a downward series of increasingly large intervals, followed by a pentatonic scale.
As the sun rises on the scene, the rest of the orchestra begins to rumble below these lines with a rather repetitive motif of two downward quarter notes, followed by two upward eighth notes. This grows in dynamics and texture until we reach the epitome of the sunrise.
It's easy to see why people in Paris at the time liked to compare the music of Ravel and Debussy. If you've ever heard Debussy's La Mer, which is brilliant, go listen to it right after you finish this, then you'll recognize the technique of flowy quiet notes in the background, and a repetitively building motif that grows until it reaches its breaking point.
Now is also a good time to point out why Ravel is often considered part of the Impressionist movement. Of course, you've seen Impressionist paintings by such artists as Monet, Degas, Renoir, and Cassatt, to name just a few. And their style, of course, relies on little dabs of color here and there, with nothing too distinct when it's viewed up close in the very tiny details. But when you move further away, you get a very clear impression of what the artist was going for when all the colors and brush strokes come together.
This sweep by Ravel is very much the same. If you try to very closely listen to each line, it doesn't make much sense. For example, again at the beginning of the piece, if you were only listening for the flute, you could hear the first measure, but then what they're playing is taken over by the clarinet in the second. And they trade back and forth for a while, but when you just listen to the line as a whole, you hear one cohesive idea, which is what Ravel intended.
In the story, part of the reason Pan rescues Chloe is because he remembered when he fell in love with the nymph Syrinx. He dreams about that time before going to rescue Chloe, and that is depicted in the music with an extensive flute solo. Before he snaps out of his dream and jumps into action.
Now, to bring up Debussy once more, he published a popular solo for flute titled Syrinx in 1913, the year after the premiere of Daphnis and Chloe. The piece was meant to be part of a larger work that was never completed. This similarity to Ravel's work could be a coincidence, just a French obsession with Greek myths. And for this particular myth, the flute is a good instrument choice, because Syrinx is also the name of the organ songbirds use to tweet. But it could have been a challenge to Ravel.
The final section of this piece is much more fast-paced than the introduction, however, it somewhat echoes the motif we first heard with the quarter notes and eighth notes. Here, the notes are much faster, but the overall contour of the line is the same. A longer percentage of the measure is spent in downward intervals, and at the end, it winds back upward.
In this ending section, Ravel also lets the brass get in on the texture. This is a distinctly different tone than the woodwind texture that was created at the beginning of the piece. While at the beginning it was soft and warm, the brass now lend a more pointillistic and bright quality.
In the finale of this piece, Ravel does a very brave compositional technique. He really has the orchestra going in full force with all the instruments playing, but sometimes everyone except some select brass instruments in low strings drop out. However, his writing is good enough that even with this drastic texture change, the overall excitement and bombastic feeling doesn't fizzle out.
This is truly a monumental Impressionist work. Though Ravel instilled it with his modern French style, it's still highly accessible and enjoyable for the crowds. And if you find the Coffee House highly accessible, help us reach more crowds by sharing us with a friend and leaving us reviews on iTunes and Google Play. For the Coffee House Classical Music Podcast, my name is Asa.
And I'm Allison. Thank you so much for listening. The Daphnis and Chloe Suite No. 2 was performed by the DuPage Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Barbara Schubert. You can find The Coffee House on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Remember to rate, review, and subscribe. You can follow us on Facebook or Instagram. Email us at coffeehouseclassical@gmail.com.